6 minutes before the Eagle lunar module was set to touch down on the moon, the tense voice of astronaut Neil Armstrong came through to Mission Control in Houston. A yellow caution light was flashing on the computer in the cockpit, the 1202 alarm. And neither Armstrong nor fellow astronaut Buzz Aldrin knew what that alarm meant. So, should they continue to the moon or abort the Apollo 11 mission? That call would come down to a 26-year-old NASA guidance officer named Steve Bales. 50 years ago, men landed on the moon because Steve said one word, go. And Steve Bales joins us now. Hello, sir.
How are you doing, Jesse? It's great to talk to you.
Yeah, I'm doing well, thank you. A real privilege to meet you. How does a kid from a very small town in Iowa end up in the hot seat in Mission Control for that first mission to the moon?
I used to go out and look at the stars at night. We lived in a small farming community, and my father would point out a few of the constellations. And that got me really interested in space. And then, as your readers and listeners may know, we had this shock in the United States called Sputnik. And that really incentivized me and many others in my age group to do something that we could. And I was pretty good at math and science, and Iowa State had a good engineering school, and I went there. And luckily, I was accepted, and they helped me get through. And the last year that I was in school for the summer, I got an internship offer from Houston, which was the best thing that probably ever happened to me.
Can you just help our younger listeners out? What was Sputnik,
sure,
and why was that such a motivating event?
Sputnik was the first satellite launched into orbit, and it was not by the United States. It was by the Soviet Union. We could have probably launched one, but for some reason didn't think it was that important. It was a tremendously important. The world all of a sudden started to think Soviet Union is ahead of the United States. Wasn't the case, but it appeared to be the case. Mm. And then, a few years later, they launched the first human into space, Yuri Gagarin. Again, they were first. We were trying to catch up, did catch up, but only caught up after President Kennedy made the challenge, let's go to the moon. At that time, it's hard to describe to your younger readers and listeners, but there was tremendous anxiety here in the States about, are we behind? Can we catch up? What are we supposed to do? And the Apollo program was a big part of solving that problem.
And people like you felt a sense of service to the country, like you wanted to be part of the solution.
Absolutely. When I was in college, we had our first launches of Mercury, and the Apollo program was yet a dim hope in the future. But fortunately, when I was an intern, they were just building the new control center in Houston. And I would have a chance to observe it, look at it. In fact, one of my jobs as an intern was to be a tour guide. And so I had to learn at least a little something about what each of the positions did.
Mm-hmm.
And to do that, I had a chance to go to talk to the people that would actually be sitting there and doing things for the first Gemini missions. And after I did that summer, there wasn't any place else I was going to go. I immediately started to talk to everyone there. How do I get a job? Who do I talk to? Where do I make application? And that really helped me get an offer from Houston that next fall.
I think I read somewhere there were 400,000 people responsible for landing Apollo 11 on the moon. So what was your job, Steve?
My job was called the guidance officer. The guidance officer sits in Mission Control at one of those consoles and is responsible for all the functions of the guidance system. Now, at the heart of the guidance system is something called the Apollo computer, but it's the guidance system is a lot more than that. It's the computer taking in information from radar, from accelerometers, from rendezvous radars, and figuring out where it is and how fast it's going and where it's going to go, and guiding the vehicle to the ground in case of a lunar descent. In the descent phase, for the first 10 minutes, it's automated control. The crew can't even see the moon for all that time, and so they're relying on this small computer who is sensing all these other instruments to take them there. And my job was to make sure that system as a whole was doing everything right, and if there was a problem, to make a call on whether we should continue or not continue based on the health of the guidance system.
You were just 26 years old, and a lot of the team were young, most of them. Was youth an advantage because maybe you didn't know how scared you should have been?
Probably was. And all, as you say, the all the controllers were 27, 28. I was 26. I was probably the youngest one. I was 26. Flight director Gene Kranz was 36. So that was he was the oldest one. He was the old head, and he really was the leader. And we were lucky that we came on at a time when the people that probably could have done a better job than us were already having to move up and manage the program so it would be successful. And so they needed people to come in. There wasn't a lot of experience in the area I was in. There was some in guidance, but not a great amount, especially on how to monitor it during a mission. And so I had a chance to learn from the ground up and listen to others and watch others during the Gemini program and be ready for the Apollo program.
Buzz Aldrin and Neil Armstrong must have seemed like old men to you.
They were. You know, these days, I believe the astronauts and flight controllers are much closer in age and probably closer in relationship. Buzz Aldrin and Neil were like heroes from the Korean War, and so were the others. And also, they were gone a lot from Houston. They were all over the country, all over the world, training at various simulators and facilities. And the training system for Apollo at that time was at Cape Kennedy. So their simulators were at Cape Kennedy, and when we were training, we would be in Houston, they would be in Cape Kennedy. So I knew who they were, and I knew who we were, but we didn't meet a lot. It was more of a professional, we know who you are, let's talk about what we got to do when we do get together in meetings. But that was about the extent of it.
Steve, what was it like walking into work that day, the day of the moon landing 50 years ago?
We walked into the room at 7 in the morning, I think, Houston time. It was like walking into a place where you could have cut the tension with a knife, and it got nothing but worse for the next 8 hours. Because we had 8 hours of very, very difficult work. We had to power up the vehicle. All the different flight controllers had big responsibilities there. Mine was to make sure the computer knew where it was aligned, how it was, the programs were functioning properly, that we had told it where it was going to be when we started the lunar descent. And it was just hard work after hard work. An hour and a half, we would have communications with the vehicle, and we would work as hard as you can imagine those hour and a half. They'd be gone behind the moon for 30 minutes. We'd keep working because we had to be ready to start doing different things the next revolution. And we did that until finally everything was ready, the vehicle separated, and they went behind the moon for the last time. And then we were sitting there, and I think that's the time where it really started to be even more tension at that point.
I'm talking to Steve Bales, who was the guidance officer on the Apollo 11 mission, who made that famous call to proceed after the astronauts noticed a 1202 alarm. We'll get to that moment in a second. And Steve, can you tell us, you mentioned a guy called Gene Kranz. He was the flight director. How did he prepare your young team for that incredible day back in July 1969?
Gene Kranz he also was in Korea. I think he missed the actual war. He was there a couple months after the war was over, flying at jet fighters. He was an incredible leader and knew each of us and how we would all react. I cannot imagine anyone else. I'm sure others could have done it, but I personally can't imagine another man being in control of this team during these 13 minutes to landing. In fact, many of your listeners may be more familiar with him from the movie Apollo 13, Failure is Not an Option, because he's the one that Ed Harris played the role of the flight director,
right.
Played him as the flight director. Gene knew that he had a bunch of young guys ready to do what they had to do, but he also knew that it would be good for him to remind us what we were going to do just before the vehicle came into contact. So he called us to a private loop, and he said, this is it. This is what we've worked for years. This is what you're meant to do, and we're going to do it today. Then he said something I'll never forget. He said, whatever happens when we walk out of this room, we walk out as a team. You can't imagine how important that was to me. Because I knew that we had three things that could happen to us. We were either going to land, we were going to abort, or we were going to crash. And we were praying that the first one was the one that would happen. But that, what he said really, really helped to get ready. And I still can remember that as clearly as if he said it yesterday.
So minutes before the Eagle was meant to land, you hear Neil Armstrong asking for a reading on an alarm going off in the lunar module 1202. And could you tell from his voice that there was real concern? First of all, it was quite rare to hear his voice, right?
It was. Now, Neil said they didn't know what it was. Actually, the only reason we knew what it was is we'd seen it in a simulation just before the launch. This alarm was never supposed to come up. It was only to come up as the computer was getting overloaded, and there'd been run after run after run training. Nothing like it had ever happened. But there was a problem, unknown to us, that was overloading the computer, and right at that time, it had hit 100%. Couldn't get everything done, and said, I didn't get everything done, your call, essentially is what was being said. That my back room reminded me, this is an alarm that if it doesn't come too fast, we're okay as long as everything else is okay. And since I had ability to look at the speed and the altitude and the rate of descent, the guidance commands and everything else, the vehicle seemed to be doing fine. The computer was doing fine. And based on that, we said go. But it took us 15 to 18 seconds to make up our mind because it really was a shock. And that doesn't sound like a long time, but in the power descent, that's an eternity. And we, thank the Lord, managed to come up with an answer that was the right one. And Charlie Duke heard me say it. I screamed it almost. And he immediately said, Eagle, you're going. We got you a go on that alarm. We kept going. Buzz Aldrin calls up another display right after that, and it happens again. We said the same thing, you're go. These were all at about 35,000 feet. So we told the crew, don't call that display up again. We'll monitor these parameters on the ground for you. And they didn't. They just stayed off the disky. The disky is the shorthand for the crew keyboard. And we managed to go then all the way down to 7,500 feet. At that point, the computer pitches the vehicle up. You'd killed off enough velocity so that it can look down and the crew can see the moon, trying to figure out where they're going to land. And quickly they see that they've gone about 4 miles too far downrange. They had an idea this would happen. We told them it was probably going to happen. And as they get lower and lower, they see the terrain is really rough where the computer's about to take them, and Neil takes over manually. The other problem we have is when you're in this program, it works even harder, and we start getting more alarms. And so I had to do the same thing three more times. We had three more of these 1201, 1202 alarms, and I had to give a go each time. We're continuing to go. We work down, the vehicle works down to about, 1,000 feet, and now Neil takes over manually, because he's going to have to guide across a big crater the size of a football field. I guess you'd call it a rugby field. he's trying to guide across. The good news is when he takes over manually, that relieves the computer of a lot of its work, and the alarms don't go away. There are no more alarms after that. But then we have big problems with fuel. He's about to run out of fuel. We're getting close to it. And if you listen to the air of the ground, that's where you hear the word, the 90 seconds, and then 60 seconds. And we never thought we'd get below 90 seconds. We're down to 60. The propulsion engineer named Bob Carlton has got his stopwatch going. He gets down to 30 seconds, and all of a sudden we hear picking up dust, and then contact light, and then Houston, Tranquility Base here. The Eagle has landed. And what an incredible thought.
Okay, now I want to get your reaction when that happens. I just have to go back to that moment where you say go. How much, and to give people an idea, like if you make the call to abort, that's this whole mission, all the energy, time, money that's gone into it, the hopes and dreams of 200 million people, the world is watching, the political ramifications that come with it. In that moment, that's just you. So how much certainty did you have that saying go was the right thing to do?
You know, there was no certainty at all. It was just the best thing to do. Not the guaranteed thing to do. It's funny. You know, there's a school of thought that said good outcomes don't mean there were good decisions. Mm-hmm. That may be true, but it's much better to have a good outcome. It's much better to have a good outcome. We could have gotten in big trouble, no question about it, especially when we got low, when we got below the 3,000 feet. Once we got to 700 feet, he had some other options to manually land, but there was no guarantee that what we were doing was right. We were doing the best thing that we knew how to do. The other thing we were trading off, if we'd have said stop, the lower you get, the more risky it is, because then the vehicle has to pitch around and try to make it back up into orbit. It's going to run out of the fuel that's in the landing stage. They're going to have to do an emergency separation and use the ascent stage. The landing vehicle had two stages, one where the engine was used and the fuel was used to land, and another one where it separated out and the small part of the vehicle came off and had an ascent engine. And you tried to do an abort when you were below, 20,000 feet, and you had to use both engines, and it was quite risky. So trading off risk versus risk, I'm convinced we made the right decision, but it was not guaranteed that it would work out well.
Have you thought, people talk about luck and preparation, have you thought about the ratio of luck to preparation on that day?
Where we were lucky is we saw a similar case 2 weeks before the landing, and we got in a big argument about what we would have done. I aborted the mission when that thing came up. It was a similar alarm. And I aborted the mission, and we got in a big argument, what should we do? And that's when Gene said, I want you to go off and make sure that you have rules you'll follow when one of these alarms come up. I said, Gene, there is no way any of these are supposed to come up. These are put in there for software checkout. He said, I don't care what you think, you go do it. And that's what we did. Jack Garman and I, my support, Jack did most of the heavy work on that, working with MIT and others to say, okay, if we get certain alarms, we're going to try to keep going as long as they're not coming too fast. Other alarms, we can't do anything. We have to stop. And this was one of those that we got that we had pre-thought out and knew that we were going to have to make a call, but we also knew it wasn't guaranteed we were going to make the right call. So in that sense, we were lucky and prepared, I guess you would say.
I'm speaking with Steve Bales, who was the guidance officer for the Apollo 11 mission. He was monitoring the landing computer on the vehicle. Is it possible, Steve, to describe how you felt when you heard those words, Tranquility Base, here the Eagle has landed?
I'll tell you, there's a surge of yes for about 10 seconds.
Mm.
And then we had to get ready for a lot of things on the surface. There was a possibility we could take off in 2 minutes. In fact, if you listen to the air-to-ground, instead of saying go, now we start saying stay, just to make sure it's absolutely clear what we want the crew to do. And so we had to get ready. If something went wrong with the environmental system or if the vehicle started to tip or something else happened, we had to get ready to go in 2 minutes. And that was intensive time. And then, once we get by the two-minute part, we have to get ready to go. There's another gun, decision to make it at 10 more minutes. We had to get ready to do that. So it was almost impossible to understand what had really happened, other than we knew they were on the surface. But there was no time to enjoy it, be glad about it, or anything else, because we could have gotten right back in and had to lift off. And I guess people would have argued for years if they never would have been able to get out of the vehicle, did they really land? And of course they did, but it would have prevented them from stepping on the moon. So we're grateful that everything was calm after they landed and we were able to stay for the 24 hours.
Did you get to watch the moonwalk?
I'll tell you a funny story. Gene comes around and he says, I want you to go with me over to the press conference there's a press conference after every shift, and you can imagine it was a big press conference after this one. And I was so tired, I said, Gene, do I have to go? He said, yeah, you do. So, because somebody may ask something about the alarms. Well, I go over, and this room, normally there are quite a few press people there. This room was just packed, you can imagine. And I was so tired that I almost fell asleep in a press conference. And all I remember is nobody asked about the alarms because they really, at that time, nobody had had a chance to brief them on it, and they were more interested in what we felt and what was going on with the crew and that sort of thing. And they let us go early because one of the press reporters said, you guys look like you're beat. I'm sure you'll come back and explain more later. And that was the best thing a press person has ever said to me in my life. And so we all go out as a team. And we go back over to, there's an area in sort of a lounge in behind Mission Control. And we know that the crew is going to come out early. So we stay as a group because there's a different team now in Mission Control monitoring the surface activity. And we watch it together. I mean, we all watch him come down the ladder and step off the moon. And what a incredible, incredible thing that was. And then I just went to sleep in one of the bunk rooms that was behind Mission Control because I had to get up the next day and monitor the launch phase, the ascent phase. And but that's how I watched it. I watched it with a team of the people that had landed us on the moon.
And Steve, you're 26 years old at this point, and you played a crucial role in getting man to the moon. How do you top that?
You get married to a wonderful woman. You get you have some great family, which I wasn't married at the time. There were a lot of divorces in the Houston Space Center at that time. But short of that, it's pretty hard. But life goes on, and after a while, it's sort of like in a distant past, except when we have an anniversary like we're having now, obviously the big one now at 50 years, and then you start remembering, and you talk to some of your friends. I live here in New Jersey, which is, actually my wife and I run a business. I've been doing that for 20 years. I've been out of the space business a long time. But at this time, you keep in touch with the people you worked with, the ones that are still living, and you remember things, and you're glad that you were part of it, and you're grateful that it turned out so well, because it did. It could have turned out differently.
And over that 50 years, have you reflected on why the Apollo mission worked, not just from a technical aspect, but, you know, everything from the political will to the leadership and the dedication it takes to make something like this happen?
Yeah, it did. It took a person like John Kennedy to have the vision. And even he wondered if he'd had the right vision, according to some of the more recent historians studying papers and other things. Once, unfortunately, as everyone knows, President Kennedy was assassinated, but his memory lived on, made it very strong in everyone's mind. That's something the country was going to do. The other thing that happened that I don't think anyone realized is how much technological advance the Apollo program brought about in our country and about the world, too. I've read recently, I didn't know this, that 50% of the transistors that were made in the 60s were made because of the Apollo program. There was a drive. We had to make lots of things, software, transistors, monitoring procedures, communications in space, that really were beneficial to the country, even more than I thought. So you had the drive, the leadership, the country behind you, the need to do it from a political sense, from a geopolitical sense, and it was important. Whether those will all come together again in the near term or not will be to be determined. I hope it will, but I don't think there's a guarantee.
Thinking about your childhood in Iowa, looking up at the stars, do you now hold your gaze for just a little longer when you look at the moon?
I do, and I'm grateful, because if you think about it, it was a wonderful success. It was one of the few times that the world's attention was held on something, and it was positive. There's so many times that we get held on something as a species, and it's not positive. And I'm sure you know some we've had in this country. The 9/11 terrible terrorist attack was one, for example. But this was a positive thing. And so I look up and I think, thanks that it worked so well, and thanks that we can look up and we don't have to worry about something that went wrong. When I see the moon from time to time, I'm grateful for all those things.
We're grateful for you, Steve, and for your service. Thank you so much for your time today and for recalling that special day 50 years ago. It's a real privilege to speak to you, and from all of us here in New Zealand, thank you.
Thank you very much. I enjoyed talking, and have a great day, and I enjoyed talking to you very much.